From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. On this Martin Luther King Day, we're going to bring you three of our favorite interviews from Radio Times past about activism and eloquence. We'll feature my interview with physician Nadine Burke-Harris, a leader identifying the health consequences of childhood trauma. She's the founder and CEO of the Center for Youth Wellness, author of The Deepest Well. We'll also hear my conversation with pediatrician Mona Hannah Atisha about how she sounded the alarm about lead levels in Flint, Michigan's water. She's been credited with helping to put the spotlight on this public health crisis. But first, poet laureate Tracy K. Smith tells us how she first became interested in poetry, and we'll read some of her poems. That's all coming up when Radio Times continues after the news. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Today, for Martin Luther King Day, we're bringing you three conversations about activism and eloquence. And we begin today's show with Tracy K. Smith. She's a professor of creative writing at Princeton University, who was named the Poet Laureate by the Library of Congress in 2017. She's published several collections of poetry, the latest being Wade in the Water. She joined us not so long ago to talk about her work and her life, which she wrote about in her memoir, Ordinary Light. Let's listen. What's interesting, and I guess poets labor under this, which is helping the rest of us not feel so either afraid of poetry or misunderstanding poetry, or somehow feeling as if poetry is over there and it's not part of our lives.
Yeah.
Do you understand that?
Well, it's funny. I have young kids, and I see every day how they are quite naturally poets. They live in metaphor. They have a sense of wonder and transformation and association that is what poems are built of. And then I think that throughout life, we get pulled away from that mindset. We get told that logic and order are the governing principles. And then sometimes we get told that poems have an ulterior motive that we've got to try and...
We don't trust them?
Yeah, we're made to think the poem is saying one thing, but it's really saying something else. And I think that's probably a misguided way of saying there's lots that's active in any given poem. And the surface of language and the surface of content is a real feature of a poem, and that's something that you can lean on. And you can also trust that it might guide you to think about other related or even sort of tangential topics differently.
I read that there was this famous Emily Dickinson poem, I'm Nobody, Who Are You, that just grabbed you.
Yeah.
How come? And I have it right here. It's very simple.
I felt... Should I read the poem?
Yeah, I was going to say, let me pass this across the table there. Go ahead.
I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. They'd banish us, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog, to tell your name the livelong day to an admiring bog.
So simple, and yet...
It's so simple and joyful. The sounds of language and the images, I can, you know, recall thinking, oh, how interesting to think of a frog as something public. But what spoke to me most powerfully was that first line of the poem, or that first stanza, where someone is saying, I recognize something in you that is true for me, and feeling drawn into what I always think of as a sense of collusion, being made to recognize something that felt true about myself that I'd never thought of before. And I think that's what good poems do all the time.
You felt like a nobody. I mean, I think a lot of us have gone through periods of our life where you felt like a nobody.
And then this poem kind of turns that into something that's beautiful. Like, how wonderful to be able to protect this inner strangeness, this private space, and have it for yourself at least some of the time. The truths that poems alert us to are changing. You know, like you return to a poem 30 years later and you find something different within it. But that's something that really excites me. There's a momentary truth that a poem can give you access to, and that can be enough.
You wrote a poem, as I understand it, in response to that poem called Humor. Is that true? And do you remember a line or two?
I remember the very pompous closing lines of the poem. So I thought that Dickinson's speaker was wise. That's what I really wanted to embody. And I wrote a poem that was thinking in very serious terms about the value of humor. And it ended, "Treat me well, for I shall," or "Treat me with care, for I shall do you well in years to come." You know, not very poetic lines, but
not bad.
There was a wish in there somewhere.
Well, I'd love to have you read one of your newer poems, and this is from your forthcoming book of poetry called Wade in the Water.
Yeah. This is a poem that emerged out of visiting a Ring Shout performance in Georgia. And I entered into the space, and one of the performers, who I now know is a really beautiful woman named Bertha McKnight, she's a member of the Geechee Gullah Ring Shouters, greeted me, and she said, "I love you."
I'd been just like that.
Yeah, I'd been, you know, visiting a lot of historic sites, places that were commemorating the tragic, you know, institution of slavery in one way or another, and the people who came out of that, and the culture that came out of that. And so there was a part of me that was hurting on this trip, and then to be greeted by someone who is a steward in some ways of a culture that emerged from that institution. And to be greeted with such love was healing. Wade in the Water. One of the women greeted me. "I love you," she said. She didn't know me, but I believed her. And a terrible new ache rolled over in my chest, like in a room where the drapes have been swept back. "I love you. I love you," as she continued down the hall, past other strangers, each feeling pierced suddenly by pillars of heavy light. "I love you" throughout the performance, in every hand clap, every stomp. "I love you" in the rusted iron chains someone was made to drag until love let them be unclasped and left empty in the center of the ring. "I love you" in the water where they pretended to wade, singing that old blood-deep song that dragged us to those banks and cast us in. "I love you," the angles of it scraping at each throat, shouldering past the swirling dust motes in those beams of light that whatever we now knew we could let ourselves feel new to climb. Oh, woods, oh, dogs, oh, tree, oh, gun, oh, girl, run, oh, miraculous many gone. Oh, Lord, oh, Lord, oh, Lord, is this love the trouble you promised?
Wow. Thank you so much for reading that, Tracy K. Smith, reading, I guess, the title poem from your forthcoming book, Wade in the Water. There's such a shift here from this woman welcoming you and telling you she loves you, and then all of a sudden, you know, we're being chased in the woods.
Yeah.
For fear of our lives.
Yeah. It was a really powerful performance. I don't even feel like that's quite the right word. We were invited into a space where it felt like something sacred was happening, and it had to do with history, and it had to do with a sense of resilience and what I really can only describe as love or compassion that, you know, these people embodied. And when I came away from that, and I couldn't stop thinking about that moment, and it actually provided me with a different vocabulary for the kinds of questions that I had been working on in the poems that I've been working on these past years, poems that are invested in history, poems that are thinking about justice,
right?
Poems that are thinking about, you know, our private lives and the way that we relate to each other. I realized that this sense of compassion is a gift that we all have access to. We can be giving this to each other all the time, and yet it's terrifying for whatever reason to do that.
Yeah.
And I'm so grateful to that, to Ms. McKnight for just framing it so simply.
Are you a religious person? Do you think of yourself as a religious person today?
I think I'm becoming more religious.
More religious.
You know, and I never used to even feel comfortable using that word. But I feel that I believe in something large. And part of writing Life on Mars was about trying to enlarge the sense of that other thing from what it was given to me, how it was given to me in the, you know, Sunday school of God with a long white beard saying, "Don't do this, don't do that." I wanted something that was on the same scale as this vast universe. Mm-hmm. And so the poems are struggling toward that kind of hybrid view.
So interesting, your book, Life on Mars, is in many ways constructed around your father. And your memoir is really so much about your mother.
Yeah.
And being her daughter.
I think that losing my father put me back in touch with that early loss and helped me to process it in a way that I hadn't been able to when I was 22.
You were 22 when your mom died.
Yeah. And my father died 14 years later. And I knew him as an adult. I knew myself better. And I was able to think about letting go of him in a way that felt more complete. I don't think you can ever really complete that process. But I hadn't gone through that with my mother's death. And so writing the book helped me to do that.
Yeah. I was talking to you about this before going on the air, but I have been with loved ones as they have died and taken mm-hmm. their last breath, which you write about in this memoir. And there is that moment when someone is alive and then they are dead.
Yeah.
And it is that last breath that
yeah.
just escapes through their mouth or their nose or their body, and then somehow they're gone.
Yeah, they're carried somewhere. It really feels like a departure rather than a disappearance in a way. Maybe that's just something I've been kind of trained to recognize. But I felt a similar sense of proximity to that other realm when my children were born. You know, this sense that there's this largeness we belong to that we will return to.
The people come and go, right?
Yeah. This is a poem that's kind of struggling with that sense of the mystery, kind of wishing it closer. The angels. Two slung themselves across chairs once in a motel room, grizzled in leather biker gear, emissaries for something I needed to see. I was worn down by an awful panic, a wrenching in the gut, contortions. They sat there at the table while I slept. I could sense them with a deck of playing cards between them. To think of how they smelled, what comes to mind is rum and gasoline. And when they spoke, though I couldn't, I dared not look, I glimpsed how one's teeth were ground down almost to nubs, which makes me hope some might be straight-up thugs, young, slim, raw, who bounce and roll with fearsome grace, whose very voices cause faint souls to quake. Quake then, fools, and fall away. What God do you imagine we obey? Think of the toil we must cost them, one scaled perfectly to eternity. And still they come, telling us through the ages not to fear. Just those two, that once and never again for me since, though there are there sightings, flashes, hints, a proud tree in vivid sun, branches swaying in strong wind, rain hurling itself at the roof, boulders, mounds of earth mistaken for dead does, lions in crouch, a rust-stained pipe where a house once stood, which I take each time I pass it for an owl, bright whirl, so dangerous and near. My mother sat whispering with it at the end of her life, while all the rooms of our house filled up with night.
That was my 2017 interview with poet Tracy K. Smith. She's got a new podcast about poetry called The Slowdown, produced by American Public Media. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking about the ongoing water crisis in Flint, Michigan, from one of the people on the front line who was sounding the alarm. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. In the spirit of activism of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we're going to bring you a conversation with one of the people on the forefront of bringing awareness about the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. Mona Hanna-Attisha is a pediatrician who collected data detailing the dangerous levels of lead due to a contaminated water supply. She joined me last year to discuss her work and the tragedy in Flint, which she wrote about in her book, What the Eyes Don't See. Let's listen. Flint today, how is the water supply in Flint today?
So the water quality has improved dramatically. Our lead levels are much lower and maybe even better than other cities right now. However, Flint is still under a public health emergency. The people of Flint are still required to use filtered water or bottled water because we are doing the infrastructure work of pipe replacement. Whenever you do earth-moving infrastructure work, you displace the lead scale, potentially, that's underneath. And because of that reason, people of Flint still need to take precautions.
I read that there's no more free bottled water, that people have to now pay for their bottled water. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the state ended the supply of free bottled water. We still have filters in place for the next few years, but the bottled water is now being supplied by faith-based organizations and nonprofits like the United Way.
You mentioned the fact. So is the goal then to replace all the pipes in Flint, Michigan?
Absolutely. And this is something that all cities need to be doing, including Philadelphia. So Flint will be the third city in the country that is replacing their lead pipes. Lansing, Michigan, Madison, Wisconsin are the two other cities that have replaced their lead pipes. It's a big problem, especially in the Northeast and the Midwest. And more cities need to invest in that infrastructure work to get the lead out of the ground.
This happened when Flint diverted its water. It actually began getting water from the Flint River. I had to look on a map. It shows you my ignorance about the middle part of the country. But this is a part of the country, the part of the world that is surrounded by the Great Lakes.
Absolutely, Marty. So Michigan, and specifically Flint, is in the middle of the largest source of fresh water in the world. The Great Lakes is 20% of the fresh water in the world, the largest source. And Flint is right smack dab in the middle of that largest source of fresh water.
And why did they do that? Why did they divert their water supply from wherever they were getting it before to the Flint River?
That's a great question.
Which had a history of being on fire and all of that.
The Flint River actually did catch on fire twice. So for half a century, Flint was getting fresh pre-treated water from the Great Lakes, from Lake Huron. However, in 2011, Flint lost democracy, and we were under the control of state-appointed emergency management. And the goal of the emergency managers, and there was a series of them, was austerity. It was to save money. And it was decided that the water that we had been getting from the Great Lakes, you know, high-quality water, was too expensive for this poor, near-bankrupt, predominantly minority city. And that to save money, we would start drawing water from the local Flint River until a new pipeline was built to the Great Lakes. So the move to the Flint River was supposed to be temporary.
But this was 2011?
This was in 2014. 2011, we became under the control of emergency management. April of 2014, with a very simple flip of a switch, we switched over to Flint River water.
With the advantage of hindsight, if they had done something, maybe treated that water or done something to the pipes, could they have prevented this problem when they flipped over to Flint River?
Yeah, you're right, Marty. So if, you know, the fault of this crisis was not the Flint River. Many people blame the Flint River because they think about the history of industrial pollution. But if the water was treated properly, it would have been probably okay. It would have been hard to manage, but probably okay. So the treatment of that water was missing an important ingredient. It was missing the corrosion control, the corrosion inhibitor, which is a part of water treatment to prevent that whatever's in the plumbing from coming out and going into the drinking water.
The big question is why? I mean, why was that not done?
That's a great question, and that's why we have many, many investigations, many criminal charges, many lawsuits, to really fundamentally get at that why.
Well, you mentioned this is a poor city. It's a majority-minority city. I mean, do you think there was some, I don't know how to frame it exactly, something about, if not race, about socioeconomics? Because here we are, you know, the richest country in the world, and you've got a city, a good-sized city of 100,000 people who can't trust their own water.
Yeah, Marty, it's so ironic. The richest country in the history of the world, in the middle of the Great Lakes, in the 21st century, with rules and regulations that govern safe drinking water, yet there's a population of people who are predominantly poor and predominantly minority who don't have access to that. So many investigations and reports have looked at kind of the why, and most point to that this was another form of environmental injustice, that the demographics of the population, their poverty, their race, exacerbated the crisis and had it last for so much longer. Jesse Jackson called this a crime scene. Michael Moore said it was a racial crisis that never would have happened in a richer or a whiter community.
I quoted some of the residents there who were complaining about what the water looked like, what it smelled like, and how it was affecting their bodies. There were a number of women, including a woman named Leanne Waters and her family. I mean, she seemed to be...
She's amazing.
Of
an
the
amazing
numbers
mom.
Of whistleblowers, she clearly was one.
She started this whole thing. So Flint is a story of amazing activists, especially moms who were not only fighting for their children, but fighting for all children. So she was actually the person, this stay-at-home mom, who discovered that Flint was not treating its water properly. She's the one that found out they were not using corrosion control.
And she saw changes in her children, or at least its effect on her children.
Yeah, so she noticed a lot of skin manifestations, which were the first findings of this water crisis. There was a lot of things in this water that were irritating people's skin. We had bacteria in the water. Then we had a lot of chlorine added to kill the bacteria that irritated people's skin and eyes. But a lot of people were presenting with rashes and hair loss and rashes up to the waterline, when they were bathing their children. And her kids were getting sick. They were losing their hair. One of her children actually stopped growing.
You write here, baby after baby had come into our clinic. We gave them the same advice. It's fine. It's just fine. Drink the water. Of course, it's okay. I mean, you're described as one of the whistleblowers, but you also describe yourself as one of the last of the dominoes in uncovering this crisis. So even as a pediatrician, I'm assuming you drank the water of Flint. Even you didn't recognize what was going on.
Yeah, that really gets to the title of the book, What the Eyes Don't See. So lead, as you said, is colorless, odorless, tasteless. The effects of lead are also invisible. It's known as a silent pediatric epidemic. We don't see it presenting in our clinics. So I very much was reassuring my patients that were coming in, moms, should I be mixing my baby's formula with this water? Yes, it's okay. How can our water not be okay? How can the water that we turn on from our tap in America not be okay?
You even describe, I think, being in a barbecue in your backyard, and you had a friend who told you where the water was coming from in Flint, and the wheels began to turn.
Absolutely. So my real involvement began the night in my home with a high school girlfriend who happened to be a water expert. She worked at the EPA and worked at the EPA in Washington, D.C. when Washington, D.C. had a very similar lead and water crisis about a decade ago. And she cornered me in my room. Our children were playing, and she's like, Mona, Flint's water is not okay. I'm like, how can it not be okay? Of course it's okay. And she's like, well, they're not treating it properly with corrosion control. And I'm like, what are you talking about? What is corrosion control? And she's like, without corrosion control, there's going to be lead in the water. And I had never heard about the possibility of lead being in water. And very, naively, I didn't even know until that point that our plumbing was actually made of lead. Mm-hmm. This is all about what my eyes didn't see. For years, I have been treating children with lead poisoning, both in Detroit and Flint, and never before did I ever think that water could be a contribution to their lead exposure.
Would you draw blood and you'd see elevated levels of lead and say, gosh, I wonder where this is coming from?
Yeah, we'd always have to find out. We'd have to have kind of a differential, which is a long list of where could this be coming from. And it was always paint, 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 soil, 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 dust, dust, dust. Because that's how I've been trained, and that's how everybody in medicine and public health has been trained. We screen children for lead at the ages of 1 and 2 because that's when children developmentally are walking and crawling and they have hand-to-mouth activity when they're at risk for household lead exposure. Lead in water impacts an entirely younger age group, and we don't screen that age group, especially the unborn and babies who are using this for their formula. So we don't know. We don't know the extent of lead exposure in this younger population, especially since the window of detection of lead in blood is very short.
But you also say that lead is one of the most examined
Neurotoxin.
So neurotoxin. So it's not like if we haven't looked at this.
You're right. And, you know, the word lead comes from the Latin plumbum. So the elemental symbol for lead is PB. It comes from the Latin plumbum, the Roman, which means plumbing. So lead actually means plumbing. The Romans built their aqueducts out of lead plumbing. And many people, this theory is that hypothesize the demise of the Romans is because they used so much lead, not only in their plumbing, but they actually also put it in their food and did other crazy things with it. But we've known about lead's toxicity for centuries, yet we've lacked the political will to do anything about it. You know, we didn't restrict lead from our service lines till 1986, but it was not restricted from our brass fixtures and our faucets until 2014. So it is an example where the science has been clear, yet the policies have not caught up with the science.
So once you began to see, well, perhaps there's some kind of connection between this water supply and the levels of lead, how did you go about sort of figuring out its impact and where it might be in the city and which children were really greatly affected by this?
Sure. So you mentioned the amazing moms who were raising their voices and the activists and pastors and journalists. For 18 months, people were raising their voices that there was something wrong with this water. Mark Edwards, who's a renowned water engineer, when he was contacted by this mom, Leanne Walters, he came up to Flint literally overnight and, you know, packed his minivan with graduate students with supplies and worked hand in hand with the people of Flint to uncover the lead in the water. And he very much transparently was sharing, hey, there's lead in the water everywhere. This is a problem. And he was also being dismissed and attacked. Actually, the state called him something of a magician, that he was pulling rabbits out of hats, that wherever he would go, he would find lead in water. So I followed all their work. I learned about the lead in water. And I knew I needed to see if that lead and water was getting into the bodies of our children. So I conducted the research on children's blood lead levels, looking back at children's lead levels and comparing them from before the water switch and after the water switched. And what we found was, contrary to anything that was happening in our state, nation, even our city, where lead levels had been coming down in children, we saw that they increased after the water switch, the percentage of children with elevated lead levels. We saw that it directly correlated with areas that had the highest water lead levels. Parts of the city that had the highest water lead levels had the greatest increase in children's blood lead levels. And we also noticed that there was nothing happening outside of the city's water supply. And we also very much realized from that very beginning that this was an underestimation of the impact. Children weren't screened when they didn't know there was a lead and water crisis. They weren't being screened at the right ages, and that half-life of lead is so short. So it was a massive underestimation, but we publicly shared that research, that we were concerned about children's lead levels.
What was the highest level? And you write about a foster home, I think, rather near the hospital, and the levels that you found there.
Yeah. So the water lead levels that were found throughout the city were in the hundreds and thousands of parts per billion. This was the water lead levels. We had a home with a water lead level of 22,000 parts per billion. Our schools.
There
is no. So the EPA has a maximum contaminant goal of lead in water, which is 0 parts per billion. But for a water system, the action level is 15 parts per billion, which is not health-based. It's just based on feasibility. So, like, you know, there were samples, hundreds and thousands. And like you mentioned, the lowest day in this whole crisis was when we had a foster home for troubled children, which was close to the hospital, that had a lead level of 5,000 parts per billion.
Was in the water.
In the water. And these are kids who already had every adversity. And it should have ended when we knew about lead in the water. It never should have gotten to the point where we needed evidence that there was lead in children's blood, because that is too late.
Help us understand then the effect, and it should be said that decades ago, I mean, lead was everywhere in gasoline.
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, if you grew up in America, chances are you were exposed to lead. But talk about the effect on cognition, behavior, learning, IQ.
Right, Marty. So decades ago, we had contaminated this earth with lead because of lead in gasoline, lead in paint, and lead in other sources. And levels that we thought were okay then, we now know through incredible science, are no longer okay. We now know, per the Centers for Disease Control, the American Academy of Pediatrics, that there is no safe level of lead. And we also have learned that the very lowest levels can even more dramatically impact children's cognition and behavior. Lead is a potent, irreversible neurotoxin. It impacts thinking, so it actually drops IQ levels. It impacts behavior, causes developmental disabilities, attention disorders. It's even been linked to criminality. Yeah. So incredible science. The more we study lead, the more we learn about its evil. And we now very clearly know that there is no safe level, that the impact is subclinical. We don't see it with our eyes, and it impacts populations. And we also very much know that it is already a form of environmental injustice, because it's Flint kids, Detroit kids, Philadelphia kids, Chicago kids, some of our country's most vulnerable children who are already rattled with so many obstacles to development are already impacted by higher levels of lead exposure.
Which raises a number of questions, which you address in the book. One is that if you've got government officials who have betrayed you, but you need a government and government officials to fix the problem, where does that leave a skeptical public? Believing, yeah. I mean, you're saying things are better. There's progress in Flint, but I'm sure there are people living in Flint who are saying, yeah, prove it.
Of course. And it's going to take a long road to recovery. This crisis happened because, the real villains are the villains of austerity, the villains of an emasculated government. These drinking water departments, and they've been cut, they've been underfunded, there was poor morale, there wasn't an emphasis on public health. It was that ideology that created this crisis. We need good government. We need government that is responsive and accountable and science-based. That is how we will get towards a greater recovery.
Do you drink the water in Flint?
I have now learned in these last few years that our water everywhere was never intended to be lead-free. There's lead in all of our plumbing because we stubbornly did not listen to science. So I use filtered water or bottled water in Flint and outside of Flint. And for vulnerable populations like pregnant moms and small children, they should also take precautions. And there are simple things that can be done, like running your cold water, never using hot water for cooking or drinking, which I didn't even know, but hot water increases the leaching of lead from your plumbing. But always running that cold water, flushing that water in the morning, especially after periods of non-use, until we get lead out of our plumbing, until we strengthen the regulations, which are grossly weak and not science-based or health-based, we will continue to find lead. And week after week, we hear about a school or a city that is testing and finding lead in their water because there is lead in the water.
Is this why you became a pediatrician?
I am just doing my job. Part of being a pediatrician is being an advocate. It is always our duty and our obligation to protect children.
I mean, thinking of the future of kids in Flint, are they going to be okay?
Absolutely. And that is the message of this book. It's a message of the story. It's a message of the crisis, but it's a story of activism and resistance, which we all need to, hear about right now. But more importantly, it is a story of hope and recovery. We are committed. It's a city that has rolled up their sleeves and committed to making sure that the children of Flint are going to be better than okay. And we are also committed to sharing our best practices, because there are kids everywhere suffering from very similar toxicities, the toxicity of poverty and racism and lost democracy and violence and incarcerated parents. These are all toxicities. And emerging science has taught us that these toxicities leave lifelong scars. So we are actually in Flint hoping to share what we learn to other communities to protect more children.
That was my conversation with pediatrician and activist Mona Hanna Atisha, author of What the Eyes Don't See, about the Flint, Michigan water crisis. When we get back from the break, we'll hear how childhood trauma and adversity can have a lifelong impact on people's health well into their adulthood. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks again for joining us on this Martin Luther King Day. Our final interview is with Nadine Burke Harris. She's a pediatrician who works in a low-income community in San Francisco. She noticed not so long ago that many children who came in for her care were failing to thrive, not meeting their developmental milestones and dealing with serious and chronic illnesses. She began using a test called ACE, which determines the amount of adversity a child faces at home, and found that factors like abuse and neglect and poverty can have long-lasting effects even well into adulthood. Her book about all of this is called The Deepest Well. Let's take a listen to our conversation. We're talking about emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse. I'm quoting from your book here: physical neglect, emotional neglect, substance abuse in the household, mental illness in the household, mother treated violently, divorce or separation, criminal behavior in household. That's a long list, and those are each one by themselves a serious problem for a child to have to deal with. I know there's a kind of a rating system, how many times someone would say yes or no to that ACE test. When do you become concerned?
Well, we're concerned any time that a patient is experiencing adverse childhood experiences, because let's think about it. This is not like, you know, failing a test or losing a basketball game. These are threats that are so severe or pervasive that they literally get under our skin and change our biology. And so after diving into the research, one of the big ways that this work changed my clinical practice was that we began screening all of our patients for adverse childhood experiences. Because one of the things, one of the major findings from the CDC research, when they looked at these factors in over 17,000 adults, was that two-thirds of them had experienced at least one adverse childhood experience.
Wow.
And about one in eight individuals had experienced four or more. And the CDC now collects this data nationally. And of the 32 states and the District of Columbia that collect this data, all of them report between half and two-thirds of the population with at least one ACE and between 13 and 17% of the population with four or more adverse childhood experiences.
Well, I'm just trying to imagine being a child and having to check off four of these and what their life. I mean, in many ways, this is what the child's life is like. It's not, you know, losing the homework paper or losing the basketball game. It's this is your life.
Yeah, it's coming home to situations that can be unpredictable and unstable at times. And oftentimes, you know, for a lot of my patients, when I talk about it, I don't even actually, interestingly, as awful as these things sound, oftentimes I don't even talk about trauma. I talk about drama.
Drama.
Right? Because many of these things are so endemic in some of our communities that they're just the way that things are. It's like, yeah, you know, I have a parent who's alcoholic, or, you know, sure, my dad got arrested. That's everyone in my neighborhood, their dad got arrested. You know what I mean? And so understanding how we can take things that are oftentimes really commonplace,
mm-hmm.
right? Especially if we're talking about two-thirds of the American population, right? And understand how, in many ways, it's almost like, you know, secondhand smoke, right? It's incredibly common, but for many of us, we don't know that it's damaging to our biology.
I'm thinking of the fight or flight response, which you write about, and, mm-hmm. and clearly this was one of our ways as we evolved to respond to environmental stresses, whether it was that tiger, that lion, or whether we were stressed because there was not enough to eat. So that took us to where we are. What happens when that is overstressed?
Yeah, so that's one of the things that I want to mention is that our stress response, our fight or flight response, it evolved to save our lives, right? So we release these hormones like adrenaline and cortisol, and they help to do things like raise our blood pressure, raise our blood sugar, right? Increase our heart rate. And all of those things are really good if you're trying to run away from a bear in the woods.
Right.
But the problem is if you have those hormones doing that all the time, then all of these responses in our bodies become chronic, and they go from being adaptive or life-saving to being maladaptive or health-damaging.
And literally paying with it with our health or maybe even our life with a shortened lifespan.
That's exactly right. So what the CDC and Kaiser Permanente found in this, you know, groundbreaking research study was that individuals who had four or more adverse childhood experiences had double the risk for heart disease, double the risk for cancer, 2.5 times the risk for stroke, and for individuals with very high doses, with 7 or more adverse childhood experiences, their risk of heart disease was triple, their risk of cancer was triple, and the difference in their life expectancy was 20 years.
I wonder, too, whether this study, that this ACE study that is so much a part of your practice now, whether that the fact that it hasn't gotten the kind of play that it probably deserved 20 years ago is we're still wrestling with this mind-body divide. Somehow the body is over here, the mind is over there, and we don't really connect the two.
I think it's fascinating to see the way that we in our society, you know, we have medical care and then we have mental health care. They're totally separate. Half the time, insurance doesn't pay for mental health.
Exactly.
And yet we make that distinction, but the body doesn't make that distinction, right? So when a person experiences some, you know, something stressful or traumatic, what gets activated in the body is just one system, right? And we probably do a much better job in our society of recognizing the behavioral symptoms than we do in recognize the symptoms when they're not behavioral.
This is less a medical question and more maybe a political or sociological question, but do we also blame people for their behavior? I mean, we say, you're obese, you are in jail, you're a troublemaker, and it's your fault.
I think that's one of the biggest obstacles that this is facing, because when the study was first published, some of the big criticism that the original researchers, Dr. Vince Felitti and Dr. Robert Onda, faced was, isn't the reason that these folks have these worse health outcomes because, you know, they do it to themselves. Right. They drink, they smoke, they overeat, and they engage in high-risk behavior. And certainly health-damaging behaviors, folks who have high levels of adverse childhood experiences are more likely to engage in health-damaging behaviors. And ask me, I'm going to come back to that in just a second.
Fair enough.
But even if you don't engage in any health-damaging behaviors, you're still at greater risk for all of these different health problems. And a big part of the reason for that is because of the long-term changes of an overactive stress response and the changes to our brain, immune system, and hormonal systems.
It also underscores just the amount of child abuse, neglect, whatever you want to call it, in this country, maybe other countries as well. But that's just a fact that I think we don't really deal with. And then that becomes generational. So you see patterns repeated.
That's exactly right. For kids who experienced, you know, high amounts of ACEs, and if they have toxic stress and they have an overactive stress response, guess what? When they grow up to become parents, it may be more difficult for them to hold down a job, right? Or to engage in stable and healthy relationships. And when their child does something that's perfectly developmentally appropriate, for someone with an overactive stress response, right, we're more likely to get in trouble, and it's handed down from generation to generation.
You wanted to go back to something, and I'm wondering whether you want to go back to the fact that we are dealing with this opioid crisis and whether you see a connection between that, and this is a national problem, it's an urban, suburban, rural problem, and toxic stress.
So an individual who has four or more adverse childhood experiences is 10 times as likely to be an IV drug user as someone with zero adverse childhood experiences. Wow. And when we think about the opioid crisis, this isn't just behavioral. What the research is showing, and this is why I'm so excited about this science, what the research is showing is that the part of the brain that is our pleasure and reward center, it's called the ventral tegmental area. And this is a place where, you know, dopamine is the major chemical that functions here. And childhood adversity actually changes the structure and function of the pleasure center of our brains. And it increases the likelihood of developing addictions. Hmm. And that is a big part of the reason for this connection. So as we are grappling with this opioid crisis nationally, if we are not addressing childhood adversity as a root cause, right? So, you know, prescription painkillers may have become more available. But if you don't, if we don't address the source of the driver of substance dependence, we are missing a huge opportunity to help and heal people.
One of the things you write about, the pleasure centers, is essentially for people that have lived with and dealing with toxic stress, is the pleasure center can't get enough pleasure.
Yes,
so
that's
from the
right.
drug, they don't feel the kind of high or pleasure that comes with the addiction, so they want more
that's,
and more.
That's right. It's a little bit counterintuitive. You would think that, oh, you know, drug addicts are people who just, you know, love the effect of drugs. And it turns out they actually get less pleasure from activities that should be pleasurable. And the pleasure center of the brain is activated by, you know, heroin, cocaine, opioids, all of these things, but also by high sugar, high fat foods, sex, you know, other things that we think, you know, gambling, right? So when we think about addictions, addressing the impact of childhood adversity is really critical for dealing with the burden of addiction across our society. And one of the things that I talk about in the book is that there are a number of things that we can do. Meditation helps to activate the what we call the parasympathetic nervous system, which works in direct opposition to the fight or flight system. So helping to calm our bodies down, and it actually is associated with reducing stress hormones. So that's regular meditation practice. It's one of the things that I recommend. Diet, there's a lot that we can do with diet to support reducing inflammation, enhancing neuroplasticity. And in addition, you know, good old-fashioned mental health care, like it sounds. And there are really six things that I outline in the book, but that's just to give you as a start. I think, like, don't forget just, you know, making that appointment with a mental health professional. But the last thing I would add is also talk to your doctor. Because, you know, go to your doctor and say, hey, listen, I don't know if you've heard of the Adverse Childhood Experiences study. If you haven't heard of it, would you be willing to learn with me about how I can improve my health and improve my life?
You talk about the plasticity of the brain, that first 0 to 5 years, or maybe even in your utero to 5 years. How do you intervene knowing a child might be living in an adverse environment?
So the first and most important thing, as I mentioned before, is screening, not waiting until kids have such a dysregulated stress response that they're symptomatic and we're able to see it in front of us, but doing this early identification, because all of the research, all of the science shows us that if we can do early intervention, it gives us more tools, it gives us more opportunity. Little kids have the highest degree of brain plasticity. And when we think about the development of a child's brain and body, we often associate early childhood with brain development. Right. But remember, the immune system is also developing, right? And our hormonal systems are also developing. And so doing that early intervention, the early detection, right, which requires routine screening, is just a critical part of addressing this in young kids.
But I'm sure some situations you might feel as a physician, this child needs to be removed. I mean, in order to protect this child from these toxic stresses, but that is always such a difficult thing for a child.
So that's a great question. And as a physician, I don't make the determination. I may feel, you know, I may observe a scary situation. But I'll tell you, I have met parents who have kids with really high ACE scores. But I've never met a parent who didn't love their child. And one of the things that we do, and one of the things that screening every child as part of their regular physical exam enables, is for me to say in every visit, listen, these things affect your child's health and well-being, right? It affects their ability to learn, their brain development, the way their bodies develop. And if there is a situation where it is severe and we need to intervene, oftentimes what I'll say to the parent is, because of what your child is experiencing, mm-hmm. Their body's making more stress hormones, and I think it's affecting their health. And so I want to bring resources to help you be able to reduce the dose of adversity your child is experiencing.
That was my 2018 conversation with Nadine Burke-Harris. She's a physician and the founder and CEO of the Center for Youth Wellness in San Francisco. Her book is called The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. And that does it for today's Martin Luther King edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Builder and John Ahrens, who edited this show. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us.